Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. On this, the day of the university's 144th commencement, we continue the World of Ideas tradition of hearing the work of student journalists at BU. In a frequently divided world, students in narrative radio journalism decided to spend the past semester in search of common ground. Tonight, they bring us stories about what unites people. First off, a 2016 report to Congress estimates there are more than 6,000 people in Boston without permanent homes. Many of them spend each day in survival mode, looking for food, housing, and health care, and have little opportunity to express themselves. Student reporter Madeline Bishop discovered one exception inside a modest church in the heart of the city.
Inside an old, Gothic-looking church on Newbury Street, a program called Common Art gives homeless folks a chance to share their stories.
If you were to walk into Emmanuel Church, you go through this entryway. It's kind of an older church, so it's dark and beautiful, and there's stained glass windows, and then you emerge into this large fellowship hall.
That's Amanda Grant Rose. She's executive director of Common Art. She helps lead the organized chaos in this dark yet colorful fellowship hall every Wednesday. At the front of the room, people browse piles of art supplies laid out on a long table. Behind the crafts table is a stage where about a dozen homeless people organize their belongings or sit and watch the room below.
Or you could rest, because if you are on the streets of Boston, it is hard to rest. It is hard to sleep at night. So you are welcomed in and to create the beautiful way of sleeping here at Common Art. And all are welcomed.
As anyone here will tell you, this kind of welcoming, non-judgmental place is hard to come by. Most programs for the homeless involve working towards some kind of goal. They'll help apply for benefits, find housing, or seek treatment for addiction. But as Grant Rose points out, there are very few places to go where there's no agenda, where homeless folks can go simply to be themselves.
Hey!
So anyone at Common Art is a person, not a project.
I heard about Common Art maybe 3.5 years ago when a friend of mine, I was walking from the library with him, and he mentioned this church that feeds lunch on Wednesdays around 12 o'clock.
Benson James Bernard, known here and to his friends as Benny, comes from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
So I initially heard about this awesome place just from wanting to nourish myself, and when I came in here and noticed the environment and the atmosphere and this all a welcome presence, I just got wrapped up in it.
Even though the program only lasts a few hours once a week, Bernard says Common Art has saved his life more than once.
I know there have been times that I've come in here and things that have happened to me before I came in here, and I was left feeling confrontational, or angry. And when I come here, I get a chance to just release all that.
Bernard says that gratitude for the program is shared in the homeless community.
This community, it's a very resilient one, and at times, we face hardships and we just need a break from it, and this place just allows us to get a break even for a few hours before facing reality again.
Another regular at Common Art is a woman who is not homeless. Dee Dee Cadieux is a jeweler from York, Maine. She's been making the two-hour commute to Boston every Wednesday for more than a year to teach jewelry making to the artists.
It's given my life meaning just to be here with these people. They have given me happiness. It's not just me giving back. They give it back to me. I get more hugs here in a day than I get in a year at home.
I'll get a date.
Cadieux says that here, art gives people a tool to tell the stories that they otherwise might not be able to express.
It could be joyful. It could be painful. It can be fun and happy. It can be sad and miserable.
Volunteers like Cadieux come together with the homeless artists to hang out in their own kind of community. They find a common ground in their universal ability to see beauty.
You know, it's a melting pot of incredibly wonderful, loving people with stuff. We all have stuff, but we're all here together, and it doesn't matter what your stuff is as long as we're sitting here together enjoying each other.
At a nearby table is a man who calls himself Uganda.
I'm a poet. I'm well known all over the world.
Uganda says the bright colors he paints in uneven stripes onto his canvas are his interpretation of hell, a deep, dark place that you never want to go.
My journey is a long journey. Some parts of it are painful. More actually, most parts are painful.
So why come here every Wednesday?
It's a celebration every time I come here. A wise man once said, go where you celebrate it, not where you tolerate it. That's why I come here.
This is what distinguishes Common Art from other programs. Here, no matter your faults or your setbacks, Amanda Grant Rose says, we are going to welcome you back. I'm Madeline Bishop.
The streets of Boston are common ground for many people trying to move around the city, whether it be by bus, car, or bicycle. Sharing that ground, though, can be difficult and sometimes even dangerous, particularly for people on bicycles. Student reporter Olivia Trani is one of them.
Whoop. I hear a car revving up, so I'm going to slow down a little bit. Oh, jeez. Oh, my God. That car was going by very fast.
That's me biking down a busy stretch of Commonwealth Avenue near Boston University.
Oh, God. Do not like cars.
So last year, a driver doored me, opening his car door and knocking me off my bike into the next lane. Since the accident, I've had a hard time trusting the drivers around me. Uncertainty and fear when dealing with cars is a common issue among bikers, and cyclists have their own tricks to navigate through traffic.
I think I try to look, when I'm turning, I try to look to make eye contact with drivers to make sure, especially if I'm turning left, to be like, okay, we really see one another.
Charlotte Fagan works for Bikes Not Bombs, a bike repair shop in Jamaica Plain.
I think it's just really important as cyclists to be assertive about your space on the road, because if you bike really close to the curb, it basically allows cars to pass you, but maybe at a time when it's not safe for them to pass you. But if you bike a little bit further out, you kind of like force them to give you more room as they pass you.
Fagan says that biking around Boston has even influenced how she drives.
I'm so paranoid about hitting a cyclist when I'm driving because I'm just so aware of what it feels like to be on the other side of that. So I'm looking all the time in those same spots that I know can be blind spots for people, for cyclists. I definitely feel like it's changed how I drive.
Fagan and her coworkers say Boston drivers and cyclists need to learn from each other if they want to create a safe environment on the road.
I think I want drivers to know that it's the same, and I tell cyclists the same thing when I teach clinics, is that, like, just because you want to get somewhere faster, that's not worth my life and my safety. I don't try to sacrifice other people's safety just because of my convenience.
Another longtime bike enthusiast is Ann Lusk. She has a list of safety hazards.
Potholes, doors, cars turning. Have I made eye contact with the drivers? Have the drivers indicated that they're turning with their signal?
Lusk has biked more than 1,000 miles with her daughter from Boston to D.C. and has biked around Vermont's Lake Champlain with her son.
When I was living in Japan, 10 to 12 years old, we used to take the few bikes that we had up into the hills in Nagoya, and we would bike in what were the bomb craters of the bombs that we had dropped on Japan.
Lusk still loves biking and has turned her passion into a career at the Harvard School of Public Health. She works to make sure bikers are safe on the streets. She compares Boston to an urban jungle.
You can't blame the car drivers because, from an evolutionary standpoint, they're looking out for the lions and tigers that might attack them, and that's other cars. So 11% of the car drivers saw the bicyclist before a crash. 68% of the bicyclists saw the car before a crash.
Lusk focuses on designing roads that put bikers first. Her ideas include making bike lanes that put barriers between cars and bikers, or even giving bikers their own streetlights at intersections. Lusk says the issue right now is that city planners don't often think about bikers when drawing up designs. Most biking initiatives are researched, planned, and put forward by bike organizations.
The burden to affect the change is too much on the citizens and not on the people who are salaried. There are some nonprofits that are working hard, and then, you know, they'll hold the meetings and they'll have us come out, but it's a David and Goliath. It's exhausting and it's not fair.
According to Lusk, Boston has a long road ahead to keep bikers safe. But Fagan, a New England native, has seen some improvement.
I grew up maybe an hour away from here, and the difference of what Boston used to be like 15 years ago and what it's like now is like night and day when it comes to bike infrastructure. Like, you never used to see people riding around Boston.
Back then, only 2,000 people biked to work. That's a fraction of what it is today. The American Journal of Public Health reported that in 2007,
less than a mile of Boston's streets, included bike lanes. Now, bikers enjoy more than 90 miles of lanes all to themselves. To make streets safer, Fagan says bikers and drivers need to understand each other, to see where each side is coming from.
You know, I try to remember that, like, we're all people and that they're frustrated that they're not getting somewhere.
And with only a small sliver of turf to travel on, bikers, drivers, and pedestrians need to find a way to safely share that common ground. I'm Olivia Trani.
Connecting Boston to a few outlying communities is the goal of a major public transportation project that now has experienced quite a few delays. The MBTA now estimates it'll take another 4 years to extend its Green Line rail service from Cambridge into Somerville and Medford. Student reporter Charles Borsos visited what will someday be the end of the line to figure out what impact it'll have.
Deciding not to wait for construction to finish, I hopped on a train at Kenmore Station. After a transfer to the Red Line at Park, and then a bus at Davis Station, I was finally in front of the Tufts campus in Medford. It's a journey of only about 6.5 miles as the crow flies, but it took me 1 hour and 10 minutes. With Tufts University on one side, this intersection between College and Boston Avenues will one day be home to a shiny new T-stop, and all that comes with it. The last time the T grew longer was during the northwestern expansion of the Red Line in the 1980s. Jimmy Chi-Chi has lived in Medford for more than 30 years and remembers what Somerville was like before the Red Line opened there in 1984.
Well, you're not old enough to know anything about Davis Square. But Davis Square was something like Cambodia, you know? Bombed out place. Bad. No one wanted to go there.
Chi-Chi lives behind Hillside Hardware, a local shop on Boston Avenue, near Tufts campus.
And then when they put that line in, anybody can tell you what it is now there. And so a lot of people are hoping the same thing will happen over here, in Medford, you know, because nothing happens here.
Hillside Hardware has been around Medford even longer than Chi-Chi. The hardware store opened in 1939. It's now run by Scott Spector. He's the grandson of the original owner.
We thought it was going to be great for business for us, with them buying like some of the supplies and stuff, but that hasn't been nearly as much as we thought. So I think it overall will be, I guess, good for business. I've heard that the property values for the whole area should go up.
But Spector is skeptical about the progress so far.
So I think it was
it was a 10-year project. Like 5 years, they're like $1 zillion over budget. Yeah.
Planning for the extension began in 2005, and the project was supposed to be done by 2015. But after several delays and a budget that ballooned by more than $1 billion, the State Transportation Department and the MBTA hit the brakes. Now things are rolling again with a less ambitious plan. This time, it's scheduled to be completed in 2021. A little ways down the road, Nick's House of Pizza in Medford will be one of the closest restaurants to the new station. Manager Nick Hermanides looks forward to all the business, but has some concerns.
You asked if it's going to help?
Yeah.
I believe it is. More people in the area is always good. More foot traffic. The opposite side of that, you know, I don't know what kind of people are going to be coming into the area too, you know.
Some of Hermanides' neighbors are worried too. Sean Sullivan lives a few blocks from the new station.
I think there's a flip side. You're going to get more people that are coming here that would normally have no reason or means or difficulty getting here. And, you know, it does bring in a lot of transient people, and that can increase crime and trouble in the neighborhood.
But if the 1980s T expansion in Somerville is any predictor, crime should not be a concern. The extension back then coincided with a decrease in crime rates, and crime in Somerville has been falling steadily since the 1990s. Standing at a bus stop, Tufts student Katie McLaughlin says she's more concerned about who the train station might be driving away.
The downside is there tends to be gentrification whenever, you know, public transportation, especially like a T, goes in somewhere. I know that when they extended the Red Line, you see a skyrocketing in prices for the housing around the Red Line, and I think it's complicated.
McLaughlin hops on a bus, a block from where the new College Avenue station is planned. But she's going to graduate before the Green Line extension is finished. I'm Charles Borsos.
Well, did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned. He may ride forever.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we're hearing from students in the College of Communication Radio Narrative Journalism class. The theme of their work for the past semester is Common Ground. One Boston-area effort to find common ground is celebrating its 50th anniversary. It's the Metropolitan Council for Education Opportunity, better known as METCO. The evolving school integration effort transports students from majority non-white neighborhoods in Boston to majority white schools in surrounding suburban communities. Student reporter Rob Carter became friends with a METCO student who attended school in his town and has this personal reflection.
The neighborhood atmosphere just seemed like just relaxing, you know what I mean?
That's Oscar Cruz describing Arlington Heights, the neighborhood we both went to elementary school in.
Like, I would walk outside, and I remember Tori Hegarty used to live around the corner, and we used to, like, just play basketball, and then, like, you know, her mom would give us, like, lemonade, just, like, straight out of a book.
I caught up with Oscar 7 years after we graduated from Arlington High School together. And, as old friends do, we swapped stories about growing up.
Elementary and middle school, I really didn't stay often, like in Arlington. You know what I mean? My mom and dad were just pretty, like, strict on, like, yo, you know what I mean? You got a bed for yourself.
The reason Oscar wasn't staying in Arlington is that bed was in Dorchester. Oscar was part of the METCO program. So every day, when I saw him on the playground before school, he'd gone on a bus at 5:30 in the morning to be there. When our coach let us out from soccer practice in the evening, Oscar had to ride the Red Line end-to-end, Alewife to Ashmont, to get home. But Oscar embraced it.
Like, I have my Boston friends where I, like, play soccer and stuff, like, during practice, and then I have Arlington where I see at school, you know what I mean? So it's cool, you know? It's a full day, I can tell you that.
The goal of METCO is to reduce segregation in schools. Oscar is Hispanic and lived in a majority non-white neighborhood, so he qualified to be sent to Arlington, a majority white school district.
Meeting all these, like, new families and stuff like that, meeting these new people and you know, different people, you know, I mean, like, just different backgrounds, you know what I mean? It's just, yo, I fed off that, you know what I mean? I loved it.
And I did too. Having students like Oscar, who's from a poor area of the city and is Hispanic, in my classes opened up my world. It gave me insight into more than just my mostly white, wealthy suburban town. Creating that diverse environment requires students from the city to actively opt in to becoming the out-group. And with that, opt in to different treatment by some teachers.
Yeah, there was those who, like, throwing shade at them, like, yo, are you, like, you know, you're a little sus right now when it comes to just kicking out all the METCO kids or just, like, you know, punishing all, like, the color people and stuff like that.
And that type of treatment means Oscar had to go from first grade until he graduated from Arlington High questioning whether his race was a factor anytime he found himself in trouble or if he was just making trouble.
It can be like multiple different reasons. I could have been just lazy. I could have just gave her an attitude or something like that. I could have just done multiple things. But, you know, like, as a whole, I would definitely say, like, we felt isolated.
By opting into METCO, Oscar's family signed him up not just for a longer day, but also for questions about what role race played in how he was treated. Still, Oscar is confident that the benefits outweighed any discrimination he experienced.
The good always outweighed the bad, you know what I mean? It's like, so it's just like those moments where I did feel isolated or I did feel like, yo, like I'm definitely being looked at differently because of the way I look right now, you know what I mean? Or because of the way I'm dressed or because of the way I'm talking, you know what I mean? It definitely, like, shed a light on something, but, like, yo, I'm glad it shed a light as early as it did.
The benefits as he sees them, though, weren't academic, which is why many METCO students enroll in the first place. What Oscar says he gained was the same thing I did. We learned how to hang out with each other.
A lot of other my friends, like, they're smart people, you know what I mean? And these people from Dorchester and Roxbury and stuff like that, they're not idiots. All my friends, no matter what school they went to, you know, everybody graduated, so it's like, whatever, you know? But it's the fact that I got to introduce, like, my white friends to, like, my Spanish friends, you know what I mean? And they got to click. You know, I mean, that's what made it, like, yo, that's what it's here for.
For now, Mecco only runs one way, busing non-white kids from the city into majority white suburbs. Could it ever work in reverse, with kids from the suburbs choosing to get first-hand experiences with urban education? It's not an option the Mecco board has even considered. I'm Rob Carter. One place most people find common ground is love of pets. Those pets have relatively short lifespans, but as student reporter Sukanya Charuchandra tells us, some Boston scientists are trying to change that.
Dogs really brighten people's days.
Andrew Lee spends close to 2 hours a day walking and playing with his Maltese Snow and his Shiba Inu Frost.
Dogs are one of those things that you come home from a long day and they're there no matter what. They will love you and welcome you.
Veterinary science hopes to help dogs live longer through processes that may help humans as well.
Dogs have a genome that's similar in many ways to ours.
Daniel Promislow is a biology professor at the University of Washington, where he studies aging. Promislow is combining his love for dogs and his scientific aging research as the director of the Dog Aging Project. Its aim is to help dogs live longer.
As a dog owner myself, I know that it was very difficult to watch my own dog last year, who was an 11-year-old Weimaraner, which is fairly old for a Weimaraner, to see him going downhill very quickly and struggling with the aging process. If he had been able to be healthier longer, that would have been good for me as well.
Dogs have a medical treatment second only to humans in its sophistication. One phase of the Dog Aging Project is a study that will follow 10,000 dogs for 5 to 10 years. The project hopes to answer this question. Why is it that some breeds live longer than others or are more susceptible to certain diseases?
The first goal of the Dog Aging Project is to understand the genetic and environmental factors that influence lifespan and health span.
Promislow and his colleagues are compiling data from the initial trial in which dogs were treated with the drug rapamycin that has been shown to help mice and fruit flies live healthier, longer lives.
If any animal that is beloved to a person could live a longer, good quality life, then yes, of course, people's grief would be delayed at least.
Like many veterinarians, Dr. Lisa Moses has come to realize that dogs today live longer than they did before. No one knows why that is. From her 20-plus years treating pets at the MSPCA Angel Animal Medical Center in Boston, Moses knows old dogs and their afflictions.
There are lots of things that impact quality of life near the end of life.
Anything from dementia to weakness to an inability to move.
That's the part that is the most distressing for most of the people who love those animals.
Moses recently had her dog's genome sequenced. She found out that it was, in her words, the most mixed up mutt.
For a lot of people, their relationships with their animals are so much less complicated and less ambivalent than they are with people. You know, it's a lot of times really easy to love an animal.
However, Moses says caring for an old dog, like caring for an old person, can be hard.
If people are not able, for whatever reason, to continue to take care of a very elderly animal, prolonging their life might not be in anybody's best interest.
Alyssa Krieger is the shelter manager at the MSPCA in Boston.
Anything we can do to keep our pet population healthier and happier and, you know, with us longer, seems great. The only thing is then you have them longer and you're sadder when they go, maybe, but I think that's probably a good problem to have.
My husband and I, we both have these dogs and they're like our children.
Guillermo Marx and his husband have 2 Bernese Mountain Dogs named Lula and Jack. That breed has a typical lifespan shorter than most dogs, of just 6 to 8 years. Lula is 7.5 years old. Marx says as long as dogs can live healthily for longer, the Dog Aging Project might hold potential.
We take them everywhere with us and they're great companions.
The second phase of the Dog Aging Project will launch soon. Thousands of dogs will be closely observed to find out why dogs age the way they do and how scientists can intervene in the aging process. So while the project is trying to help us understand our furry friends just a little better, it might also keep your grief away for a little bit longer. I'm Sukanya Charuchandra.
You usually find common ground in figuring out the rules of the road in this country, but in East Boston, there's a big exception to those common ground rules. Student reporter Aaron Wade explains.
Entering Maverick, the doors will open on the left side of the train.
Maverick Square's traffic flow almost seems normal if you don't drive. But if you do, you realize something's not quite right.
When you first drive into it, you know, you're confused.
Fred Salvucci is a civil engineering professor at MIT's Department of Urban Studies and Planning, and he served as the Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation.
My first reaction was, this is strange, what's wrong? And then when I got out of my car and walked around, I said, no, this makes sense. This is really a good design.
The traffic pattern in Maverick Square is kind of hard to explain. I asked a bunch of people to describe it to me, and, well, this is what I got.
Oh, my.
Okay, so close your eyes and pretend you're standing in the middle of the road. On an average street in the United States, traffic would be coming toward you on the left-hand side, and traffic would be moving away from you on the right-hand side. But Maverick Square isn't an average street. It's the reverse. If you stand in the middle of the square, traffic is coming toward you on the right-hand side, and it's moving away from you on the left-hand side. Basically, traffic flows through Maverick Square the way you might expect it to in a square in London. And Maverick sees some pretty substantial traffic.
It's the major transit hub for East Boston. It is on the Blue Line, and this is really the last stop on the Blue Line before you get to Boston. It's really the hub of East Boston.
Boston Transportation Commissioner Gina Fiandaca, standing in Maverick Square. As Fiandaca says, Maverick has been the hub of Eastie for at least the last 100 years. The square is the end of the line on the first subway tunnel built underwater in the United States. East Boston native Jean Belmonte is a historian at the New England Genealogical Society. Since the tunnel opened in 1904, Belmonte says the square has served as a common ground for East Bostonians looking to head into downtown.
A lot of people used that. It was thousands of people a day that used that tunnel, because prior to the tunnel opening and the trolleys being able to go underground, it was the ferry.
Even though a lot of people use Maverick's public transportation, the square's roadways seem like they're designed for insiders. Belmonte says she sees people going the wrong way through the square about once or twice a year.
You see it more in the summer during tourist season because people don't know where they're driving. The last time I saw someone, when they were British, so of course they were driving, they went wrong because they just assumed they were going on the wrong side. And someone yelled, "You're on the wrong side." And he goes, "I'm British. Do I get a pass?" And it was kind of funny and everybody laughed. But luckily there was no one coming in the other direction.
Even if Maverick looks at first like it's designed only for drivers who are familiar with the unique traffic pattern, Salvucci says he thinks the square's traffic flow serves a different purpose.
The thing I always was fascinated about is that it seems like it's the only spot in the city that's really designed to prioritize bus riders and transit users.
Public transit has worked together with Maverick's quirky roadways to create a connection to the rest of Boston meant for everyone, not just drivers. And Belmonte says the need for this connection creates a bit of neighborhood pride.
You know, there was a sense of community in East Boston. There always was. And I think a lot of that is because we're separate from downtown Boston. We're an island. We're kind of unto ourselves in a lot of ways.
A little neighborhood with a lot of personality and some weird traffic. I'm Aaron Wade.
Conservation can be a source of conflict and broad agreement. Student reporter Sharon Kirby has the story of the common ground found in one Massachusetts town trying to reduce its carbon footprint.
The Natick Community Organic Farm was the first town department to install solar panels. They're at the farm, where the town grows food without chemicals or pesticides, while inviting residents to get their hands dirty. Trish Umbrell is farm administrator.
There's something very
magical and wonderful about sending a kid into a tomato patch, like a patch of cherry tomatoes, particularly a kid who doesn't actually like cherry tomatoes, and they get so excited about picking the cherry tomatoes that they're willing now to try one. And, you know, every once in a while a kid will try something and say, I actually like this. And there's something about that involvement, that personal involvement, that gets over that barrier.
Kids can work in the garden at the farm, or like Annabelle Sarley, learn about the animals here.
I like feeding the goats and sheep. And I also like to look at the chickens and the little pigs and the mama pig.
How do you feel about mud puddles, Annabelle?
Don't splash!
Next to the mud puddle is the compost pile. Composting at the farm is a natural, with garden waste and manure. Away from the farm, Natick now offers curbside composting for all residents. Natick's sustainability coordinator, Jillian Martin, says residents can just drag a separate recycle bin to the curb.
Curbside composting is really pretty easy. All it is taking your food waste and separating it from your trash and recycling. And once a week, you put those bags in the curbside bin and the DPW comes and picks it up for you.
Elementary school kids in Natick are making composting personal.
For their Earth Week last year, they made these special cards, thank you cards for our compost pilot members, and they drew these really funny pictures of imagining the pilot members as heroes and, you know, kind of like the Incredibles. You know, people taking out their trash with really big muscles and having it be composted.
And the town is committed to solar.
So, for example, we have solar panels on about 10 different municipal buildings, including the majority of our public schools.
Martin says solar is contagious.
There's different solar clusters in town. So when one resident goes solar, what we've seen is that the chance of their neighbors going solar is much more likely. So we recently made a map of all the different solar installs in town. You can really see pockets of it in the community. And I just think it continues to show you the importance of leadership by example. And it shows you that when you have a neighbor who goes solar, you're exposed to the technology and you think, oh, if they can do it and they're saving money, it makes it personal for you. So you're able to imagine it on your own home and then move forward with something similar.
Martin says the move to make Natick green is a win-win. It helps the environment and saves the town money. According to the Massachusetts Department of Energy Resources, Natick reduced municipal energy consumption by 27% between 2008 and 2016, saving taxpayers $500,000.
We haven't done anything crazy. We don't have everyone in town eating granola. You know, Natick is a town that's driven by costs and by our operating budget, and we've just found tons of value in going green.
Martin is looking to the future and wants to do everything possible to address climate change, starting with Natick.
I have a 3-year-old, and I want her to enjoy the same kind of lifestyle I had. I really, truly believe that all climate change is local, and just as all politics are local, all solutions are local too. So no matter what's happening at the national level, I feel like in any town in America, residents can demand their local officials tackle climate change, and they can do that in a way that will save them money and protect our future.
Natick has done a lot to reduce its carbon footprint. Now, town leaders are asking more citizens to join in. I'm Sharon Kirby.
I'm Jack Lepiarz. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. Tonight, stories from students in the narrative radio journalism class at the College of Communication. Divisions among people with different beliefs has long confused and bothered student reporter Isha Pendarkar. In this personal reflection, she describes her surprise at finding some common ground at one Boston church.
I was born into a Hindu household, but I rejected religion at a very young age. My mom still insists on dragging me to temples whenever I visit, and I just have to stand outside because I refuse to go in. To me, belief in God seems pointless without a belief in people at the same time. People's beliefs in religion seem to contradict with their belief in logic. I thought religion should simply be about being nice to each other, but this seemed too idealistic until I visited a unique church in Boston.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Community Church of Boston.
We call ourselves a peace and justice community since 1920.
That's Dean Stevens, the current administrator of the church. He's also in charge of music there. He often sings songs with original lyrics and composition and plays guitar at Sunday service. About 30 people gather in a large, sunny, loft-like space every Sunday morning for service at the community church. It feels more like a cross between a support group and a university lecture than a church service.
It has this speaker series and this different music just about every week.
This speaker series is what draws a lot of members to the church, and it's aimed to be an educational hour and a half. Ellen Mass is a longtime member of the church, and she's on the board of directors.
And what I like about this church is that it gives speakers on every topic imaginable related to social justice and peace.
A lot of churches have a social justice committee, and we like to say that we are a social justice committee.
It's a one-way track. When you board that freedom train.
This place isn't like any other religious institution I'd ever imagined. What I saw at the community church forced me to revise my beliefs about religious institutions.
We officially kind of have called ourselves non-sectarian, but we affiliate with the Unitarian Universalist Association.
This is a Unitarian church. I didn't know what Unitarianism was, so I asked an expert. Chris Evans is a professor of history of Christianity at Boston University's School of Theology.
As a community, you are not professing one particular creed or set of doctrines. You are following belief patterns that are really generate from an individual's own study.
This explanation matches up with everything I witnessed at the community church.
We have people from a lot of different spiritual backgrounds and lack thereof.
That's right. Even atheists in a church.
I might call myself an atheist, an agnostic.
War veteran Jim Kesteris has been a community church member since the 1980s. He became associated with the Unitarian Universalist Association because he agreed with the church's opposition to the Vietnam War.
My ex-wife and I were trying to teach our kids a little peaceful, and our church wasn't even talking about Vietnam. And we felt that we needed at least that to be raised.
Solidarity and mutual support.
Again, church administrator Dean Stevens.
Joy and concern and compassion when you're sick or when you're in hard times. Desire to find common ground.
Eureka! I found a place where it is okay if I don't have the same religious beliefs as someone else. Or if I don't have any beliefs at all. I found out that what was just an idea of a perfect religious institution in my mind was an actual place. At the Community Church of Boston, you do not need to believe in God to be part of the community. You just need to believe in peace. As an atheist, I have found people whose ideas match mine in a church.
That's student journalist Isha Pendarkar. How big a role does music play in your life? It plays a major role for students at Berklee College of Music, and for a student from Syria, music has become a way to demonstrate common ground among the many cultures she has experienced. Student reporter Landry Harlan has her story.
Ahuak, ahuak, ahuak bila amali.
Next to the bay windows of her tiny Boston apartment, Nano El Rais begins to sing. She sings in Arabic, and you may not understand the words, but you can feel them. El Rais's otherworldly voice hovers around the room like incense and transports you far away to war-torn Syria.
بغرامك يلتهبون
In El Araiz's hometown of Homs, it was difficult to pursue her passion. In Syria, women might gain bad reputations if they sing. So, as a child, Araiz practiced in the one place every kid can relate to.
In the bathroom, always. It wasn't until I was 18 that my mom heard me in the shower. I was like, seriously, mom, now? After all this time I've been singing, you just heard me now.
Al-Rais's mother saw, or rather heard, her daughter's talent and got her a private tutor. Still, societal pressure led Al-Rais to Aleppo, the Syrian capital almost 200 miles away. There, she studied architecture, not music. It's an experience Al-Rais describes as brainwashing. But her voice cannot be silenced for long, especially when violence erupted in the spring of 2011.
I watched how, like, we have lost everything, our house, our my dad's, you know, business, and I watched my friends dying. Watching that, I felt that I don't want to lose the only thing I love the most, you know, music.
El Araiz's parents escaped to Lebanon, and El Araiz briefly went to England to study architecture, and then was accepted to Berkeley's prestigious vocal music program. Araiz isn't sure when she'll see her parents in person again, but she talks to them frequently via Skype.
Not so much. I don't have time.
She also uses cooking to remind her of home. Like most students, she just wishes she had more free time.
I like study, practice the whole time. But I am planning to go to salsa nights.
Just don't expect her to perform in a karaoke bar anytime soon.
I hate karaoke. They don't play the right key. So I might sing a song that I like a lot, but on a man's key.
As for El Araiz's post-graduation plans, they sound a lot like last year's movie musical, La La Land.
I really want to sing in a movie, a musical. I love to mix singing with dancing, with acting. It's just very powerful. When we do music, we are free because we express who we are, what we are, you know, thinking and feelings without any borders.
While America may seem as divided as ever politically and culturally, El Araiz is using her voice to find a common ground. In February, El Araiz joined other students from Iran, Sudan, and Syria to create an online video of the group singing America the Beautiful. Syria is still in turmoil, and refugees continue to look for new places to call home. For Araiz, that place is Boston. She calls music freedom, and Araiz is finally free. I'm Landry Harlan.
We heard stories tonight from Landry Harlan, Isha Pendarkar, Sharon Kirby, Aaron Wade, Sukanya Charuchandra, Rob Carter, Charles Borsos, Olivia Trani, and Madeline Bishop. All were students in the narrative radio journalism class at Boston University's College of Communication. Stories were edited by Professor Ann Donahue. Thanks to Mike Garth and Paul Kahlo for production assistance this week. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to wbur.org to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us for Boston University's World of Ideas.